From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the latest developments in the Middle East with James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. This morning, he had the paper's lead story about Israel's missile strike on the home of a top leader of Hamas. He and at least 14 others were killed. Hamas is vowing retaliation. A look at the Middle East coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House is criticizing Israel for an early morning missile attack on a Gaza City apartment building. The strike killed a top Hamas leader, but also a number of children and other civilians in the building. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, says the attack constituted a, quote, heavy-handed action, adding that it does not contribute to efforts to bring peace to the region. He said the Israeli government has to realize there are consequences for such actions and that this will make finding a political solution to the ongoing violence more difficult. Fleischer said the Israelis launched this attack on the apartment building with knowledge that innocent lives would be lost. The fatalities in the building included 9 children. At least 100 people in the area of the attack were also injured. The White House rejected comparisons to civilians killed and injured in U.S. military operations in Afghanistan, saying that in those cases, the loss of innocent life was unintentional, often the result of stray bombs that miss targets. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Executives from 2 big investment banks faced questions today from a Senate panel investigating the Enron collapse. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup both made big loans to the giant energy trading firm and stand to lose huge amounts in the Enron bankruptcy. Senate investigators said some of the loans that the banks made to Enron helped to disguise the company's enormous debt from investors. Officials from the 2 banks say they believed that Enron was in sound financial condition when they made the loans and that they based their decisions on the approval of the Arthur Andersen accounting firm. Arthur Andersen is under investigation for its role in the Enron debacle. At his war crimes trial today, Slobodan Milosevic dismissed prosecution charges that he ordered the cover-up of atrocities as he cross-examined a Serbian police official. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from The Hague.
Acting as his own lawyer, Milosevic disputed testimony by Serb police official Dragan Karljuša. Karljuša testified yesterday that he headed an investigation last year into the discovery of a truckload of civilian corpses allegedly transported from Kosovo into Serbia proper in 1999. Milosevic accused Karljuša of publicizing the discovery of mass graves in Serbia as an attempt by the new Serb authorities to prepare the public for Milosevic's transfer to the Hague Tribunal. Karljuša denied his probe was politically motivated. Milosevic also questioned the authenticity of a statement allegedly made by his former Secret Service chief, Rade Markovic, claiming that Milosevic gave the order to eliminate evidence of the execution of Albanian civilians in Kosovo. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, The Hague.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 82 points to close at 7,702 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 53 points to close at 1,229. This is NPR News. Graduate schools are reporting a steep increase in applications as college graduates decide to stay in school rather than competing in a tight job market. The Law School Admission Council says applications to law schools rose by nearly 18% for the current school year. That's the biggest increase in more than 2 decades. Applications also rose at graduate business, education, and journalism schools. A recent survey by the National Association of Colleges and Employers indicated that companies plan to hire about 36% fewer graduating seniors this year than they did the year before. Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton is banning imports of snakehead fish. Snakeheads are carnivorous, can breathe air, and wriggle short distances on land. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
Secretary Norton called the fish something from a bad horror movie and proposed adding it to the department's list of injurious species. That would prohibit importing snakehead fish or carrying them across state lines without a permit. This summer, dozens of snakehead fish have been found in a pond behind a strip mall in Maryland. That is a long way from their native China, and officials worry the fish could devour local species if they spread. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources put out a wanted poster saying, please kill this fish by cutting/bleeding, as it can survive out of water for several days. The department says someone released a snakehead into the pond a couple years ago. It won't name that someone, but says the person has expressed remorse. Over the years, snakeheads have turned up in 7 states. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Author Haim Potok died today at his home near Philadelphia. He was 73. Potok was a conservative rabbi whose best-known novel was The Chosen, a bestseller in 1967. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Shortly after midnight, the Israeli military fired a missile at the home of one of the militants on its list of the most wanted, Sheikh Salah Shahada. He was a founder of the military wing of Hamas. The missile flattened 3 buildings in a densely populated neighborhood in Gaza City, killing Shahada and at least 14 others, including several children. Hamas has vowed retaliation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan condemned the attack. My guest, James Bennett, is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. This morning, he went to a studio in Jerusalem to record an interview about the latest developments in the Middle East conflict, including this attack against Hamas. What does this attack represent in terms of Israel's military tactics?
Well, it's a familiar tactic that Israel's been using throughout most of the 22-month conflict. They've gone about tracking down and killing people they regard as particularly threatening militant leaders on the Palestinian side. Dozens of men have been killed this way. In many of the incidents, there's been what the Americans are calling collateral damage of civilians killed alongside the intended target. This one was particularly a devastating attack. It's been very rare, I think only on one other occasion, that Israel used F-16s in an attack like this, American-made warplanes. They did it in an attack on another Hamas leader in Nablus a year ago. They actually missed the target in that case and killed 11 policemen. The danger is obviously a warplane is not likely to be as accurate as a helicopter gunship or something that can pinpoint its target more carefully. So this was a very unusual attack in that sense, and the destruction was far greater than we've seen in most of these sorts of killings.
What was the Israeli justification for assassinating this military leader of Hamas, and what is the Hamas reaction and response?
The Israelis say that this man, Salah Shahada, was a founder of the military wing of Hamas, and they say he's responsible for hundreds of attacks in the Gaza Strip, that he's also involved in operations in the West Bank, and even has connections overseas. They considered him perhaps the most dangerous, certainly one of the most dangerous Palestinians. But it's part of the tragedy of this place that one side's cause is always the other side's effect. For Israelis, broadly speaking, the killing of this man is a just punishment and the end of something. They've removed an important threat to Israel. For Hamas, and really for Palestinians more broadly, this attack is a real provocation and the beginning of something. They accuse Israel of using what they say are terrorist tactics, firing a missile into a very densely populated civilian area, killing not just this man, but several children, at least 7 or 8 children, are said to have died in this attack. So from the Palestinian perspective, they regard Israel as the aggressor here and themselves as the attacked, responding to Israeli violence with any means at their disposal.
What kind of news is this for the Palestinian Authority? What's the relationship now between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority?
Well, the relationship is fraught between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Hamas has been gaining popularity over the course of the conflict, although there's some indications that it's topped out around 23-24%. Only marginally, by the way, behind the popularity of Yasser Arafat himself. Hamas is quite a strong organization. The Israelis say Arafat has simply been unwilling to crack down on Hamas, that there's kind of a tacit partnership there. The Palestinians, Palestinian Authority allies of Arafat say he's unable to crack down on them, lacking sufficient political support at the moment. So it's been a very difficult relationship. There has been some ceasefire negotiations, some discussion behind the scenes between Fatah, which is Arafat's organization, and Hamas. It's unclear exactly how ripe those discussions had become, but this killing obviously sets them way, way back. Hamas is in no interest now, no patience whatsoever for any talk of a ceasefire.
Hamas has been vowing a new kind of attack against Israel. They've been promising like a new, stronger type of punishment. What do you know about that?
Well, there's been talk for some time about efforts to incorporate various types of poisons and things like that in the explosives that Hamas uses. And there's been evidence, actually, of rat poison, other sorts of chemicals added, anticoagulants, things like that, to make the attack more damaging. There's also the Israelis have been warning over and over again lately of a so-called mega attack, some sort of a bombing of a major target, a very large building. There was an attempt to blow up a gas depot recently here that potentially would have created an enormous explosion. No responsibility has been claimed in that particular attack. It's not clear that it was Hamas. Hamas has also been experimenting with various types of short-range rockets that have been launched from Gaza and also now from the West Bank. They're wildly inaccurate, rather crude, but getting more sophisticated and more powerful. These sorts of things, I think, are what they're referring to.
So is Israel preparing for a new kind of attack?
Yeah, they have been preparing for a new kind of attack. They're constantly on the lookout for this sort of thing. Some of it, of course, is just propaganda. I mean, Hamas has a great interest in its mission is to sow fear among Israelis. So they want to suggest that there's a diversification, amplification of their arsenal, some new sinister, as yet unheard of, weapon. But Israeli intelligence has mined the Gaza Strip and the West Bank with informants and is constantly on the lookout for any sort of new developments like this. The man that Israel killed this morning, Sheikh Salah Shahada, Israel says was basically one of the Hamas, if not the Hamas, technological mastermind who is in charge of this effort to develop new rockets and other sorts of weaponry.
James Bennett is my guest. He's the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief. Can you give us an accounting of where Israel is now and its policy in the territories? How many cities have been reoccupied?
Israel has taken 7 of the 8 major Palestinian population centers in the West Bank, from Jenin in the north to Hebron in the south. That means that several hundred thousand Palestinians, about 700,000 Palestinians now, are essentially living under 24-hour curfew in the West Bank. Curfews that are sporadically lifted by Israel to allow people to go shop for groceries, to restock, to get medicine, things like that. But aid workers and diplomats here are talking about a looming human crisis in the West Bank. There have been reports of malnutrition among Palestinians. The Israelis are trying to grapple with this. Operation is now about a month old. Israel started in response to back-to-back suicide bombings here in June, here in Jerusalem.
Is this controversial within Israel?
It's actually got fairly broad support within Israel. The operation is quite open-ended. There's been, in contrast to past operations, this one Israel has basically undertook it with the stated objective of seizing and holding what by treaty is Palestinian-controlled territory until all terror attacks, as Israel defines them, cease. So it could go for many, many months. And in the meantime, Israel is facing the question of whether it wants to shoulder the burden of collecting the garbage, educating Palestinian children, making sure people are fed. It's seeking to avoid that responsibility, which could cost the government, it estimates, more than $2 billion a year. But the problem that they've got is the Palestinian Authority, the governing entity in the West Bank and Gaza, has been labeled by Israel a terrorist organization and is under tremendous pressure from Israel, and it's not in much of a position to provide these services either.
How is Israel dealing with leaders of countries and critics in various parts of the world who are saying that Israel is responsible for grave human rights violations in the territories?
Well, I think they're very concerned now that there's going to be a rising outcry about that very problem. And as a result, they're making it a little easier now for aid organizations to move through the West Bank to deliver food to these different areas. That seems to be their short-term approach to the problem. They're also talking about freeing up some of the $600 million in Palestinian tax revenue that Israel has sequestered over the course of the conflict, saying that the money would be used to finance terrorism. They're talking about now finding some way to hand some of that money over to help the Palestinians help themselves a little bit to feed their people.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. James Bennett is my guest. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he's joining us from Jerusalem. What is Israel saying it would take for it to withdraw from the West Bank?
Well, it depends which Israeli official you speak to. Shimon Peres, the foreign minister, said yesterday that Israel was willing to start withdrawing from some areas provided Palestinian security would step in and ensure Israeli security. Other Israeli officials are saying no way. There's going to be no withdrawal, they say, until there's a wholesale reform of Palestinian security, democracy, financial institutions, reform as Israel defines it. The Americans, the Bush administration, has now essentially signed on to that argument. President Bush, in a speech a month ago, June 24th, endorsed the central demand of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, which is that Yasser Arafat be replaced as leader of the Palestinians before there's any substantive return to negotiations here. And until then, it seems Israel has received American, if not blessing, at least implicit support for maintaining this massive, really, military presence in the West Bank.
Does Israel see a 24-hour curfew as being an incentive for the Palestinian Authority to reform, or does it see it as inhibiting reform because no one can even go out of the house?
Well, again, they argue that it is an incentive, that it's forcing them to address these problems and weakening the support for the Palestinian Authority, that is increasing frustration of average Palestinians with the kind of government they're getting from Ramallah. That frustration was already very, very high. There was a lot of complaints from Palestinians, average Palestinians, about mismanagement, corruption, lack of proper accountability, democratic representation. The problem is, to some extent, there's a backlash now, and Palestinians are feeling that though they may be frustrated with their own government, they don't want outsiders, and particularly they don't want Israelis and Americans telling them that they ought to replace their government. So to some extent, you may be actually seeing an increase in sympathy now and support for Yasser Arafat, because he's under siege again by Israeli forces.
One of the big questions is, if Arafat did step aside or was forced out, who would his successor be? You've written that that's not there's no obvious answer to that question, in part because he has tried to prevent people from usurping his power. He's tried to prevent other people from becoming very powerful within the Palestinian Authority. How has he done that?
Well, Yasser Arafat hasn't been the preeminent leader of the Palestinian people for several decades now because he's a silly or stupid man. He's a very, very clever leader, and he's been very careful to divide up power underneath himself. and play different factions, different potential leaders off against each other. He's distributed security portfolios, for example, in the West Bank and Gaza into a variety of different hands. There's more than a dozen overlapping Palestinian security agencies. You've got your West Bank agencies and your Gaza-based agencies, and the people who are in charge of one have no authority over the other. So there's a great deal of jostling underneath Arafat, but all the strings, all the power ultimately goes to him. So it's very unclear who his successor would be. President Bush, in his speech, demanded Palestinian elections, but he also demanded a specific outcome to those elections, which is that a new leadership be elected that is not compromised by terror, as he put it. And it's not clear who that would be. All of the potential replacements to Arafat here, all that have any popular support, are regarded by this Israeli government, at least, as having some links to terrorism.
One of the possible successors of Arafat is Marwan Barghouti, who's the leader of the Tanzim militia, the militia that's affiliated with Fatah, Arafat's organization. Is he still in jail? He was arrested not too long ago.
Yeah, he was arrested in the last major offensive in Ramallah, and he is still in jail, and Israel says it is going to put him on trial, accusing him of being a terrorist, accusing him of basically working on Arafat's behalf, carrying out direct orders from Arafat to kill Israelis. Marwan Barghouti is one of the more interesting Palestinian figures. He was a young leader in the first Intifada in the late 80s. He was arrested, deported, came back, and he came back ultimately as part of the Oslo peace process. He had many Israeli friends, like many of his generation, that actually grew up in the West Bank, not in exile. He's a fluent speaker of Hebrew, which he learned in prison. He also speaks English. And he formed these friendships with Israeli parliamentarians and others during the Oslo peace process, which he repeatedly said he was a deep believer in, and still says that he's a believer in a two-state solution. Israel says that over the course of this conflict, he became one of the most dangerous terrorist leaders, Israel says, on the Palestinian side, a charge he denies. He insists that he's a political leader of Fatah, and that he supports attacks on Israeli settlers and soldiers in the West Bank and Gaza, which he regards as legitimate struggle against occupation. He has always said he opposes attacks within Israel, that is pre-1967 Israel. There are various conspiracy theories, by the way, Terry, about Barghouti's imprisonment by the Israelis, at least on the Palestinian side. Some Palestinians think that Israel is essentially trying to turn Marwan Barghouti into the Palestinian Nelson Mandela, exaggerating his credentials as a potential terrorist, removing him from the scene now as the Palestinian Authority is faced with so many difficult decisions, so that he can return and possibly run for election ultimately and become the next Palestinian leader.
Do you think there's any ring of truth to that, or do you think it's merely conspiracy theory?
I think it's probably just conspiracy theory, one of many. This place is prone to them.
What's your impression of life in Israel now and the level of fear that people are living with on a day-to-day basis?
It's abated somewhat as a consequence of this current operation. There's been fewer attacks in the last month within Israel. There was a suicide bombing last week in Tel Aviv, and an attack on a settlement in the West Bank. There continue to be violent incidents in Gaza, but in general, there's been less violence within Israel as Palestinians have essentially been locked down in the West Bank. They're already surrounded by a fence in Gaza, and there's been less of a problem with attacks from there. This latest killing of the Hamas leader in Gaza is likely to increase motivation among Palestinian extremists for attacks. That motivation, diplomats here say, is already running at record levels because there's so much anger over the way Palestinians are being treated.
Since suicide bombings have been down since the reoccupation of the West Bank, have Israelis rallied behind the reoccupation? Do they see that move as a success?
Yes. Yes, certainly in the short term. People here just feel so relieved that they can go out more freely, go to coffee shops, ride the buses without such fear. There's still security guards everywhere. There's still a great deal of anxiety, but there's a general sense that people are a little freer to move around again. You're seeing restaurants fill up again in Jerusalem and elsewhere. And because of that, people are, at least in the short term, very supportive of this operation. It does create long-term problems for Israel, though, in terms of its standing in the world, possibly if there is a growing international outcry, and also financial troubles for a government that's already running a tremendous deficit, 3% of the GNP.
Also in the long term, is there a fear that the reoccupation of the West Bank is going to, in the long term, breed more suicide bombers? Even if they can't get out now, they'll get out later.
Well, this is one of the central questions of the whole operation. There is a fear among Israelis, center and left Israelis, voiced here that that's exactly what's going to happen, particularly if this operation is not accompanied by some sort of political discussion, something to give the Palestinians hope that despite what's happening now, they're on the road to statehood if they're willing to assure Israeli security, recognize a two-state solution, and live peacefully beside Israel. In the absence of that, many Israelis fear that they're just in a cycle, a downward spiral that's going to lead to ultimately to more and more acts of violence by Palestinians, and possibly no withdrawal by Israeli forces from the West Bank.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. Our interview was recorded this morning. We'll hear the rest of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at VermontVacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a profile of a Palestinian suicide bomber who changed her mind at the last minute. We continue our discussion with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with more of our interview with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. This morning, he went to a studio in Jerusalem to record a conversation about the conflict in the Middle East. Recently, a group of 55 Palestinians took out an ad in the newspaper Al-Quds opposing suicide bombing and condemning those who would try to teach young people to become suicide bombers. More Palestinians have signed on to that ad since then. What kind of conversation or debate is that ad stirring up among Palestinians?
Well, it was really an interesting effort. It looked like it was beginning to create some debate. It was a more cautious statement, by the way, Terry, than that. They said they were condemning military acts against Israeli civilians. They didn't actually use the term suicide bombing, though everybody knows exactly what they were talking about. And they were making the argument that it leads to greater hatred on both sides, and it undermines the Palestinian national interest. That is, makes their aspirations for statehood that much more unlikely to be fulfilled. This effort, which was led by Dr. Sari Nusseibeh, who's the president of a Palestinian university here in Jerusalem, a Oxford-educated professor of philosophy, began basically almost at the same time as this latest Israeli operation in the West Bank, which has had the effect of stifling that debate. It's very hard for them to conduct this kind of inter-Palestinian dialogue when they feel that they're under attack. And interestingly enough, Sari Nusseibeh himself was recently evicted from his office at Al-Quds University by Israeli security services, which accused him of being linked to the Palestinian Authority. They shut down his office. They carted out a bunch of documents. There was actually a complaint from the United States about this, and just yesterday they let him reopen his office again after he signed a pledge saying he wouldn't do what he says he hasn't done all along, which is to represent the interests of the PA here in Jerusalem.
It seemed like a really confusing move on behalf of Israel, because Sari Nusseibeh is seen as a moderate and is seen by many observers as just the kind of person who Israel should be encouraging to take on a bigger leadership position. Because he is a moderate, because he believes in... he says he believes in a peaceful coexistence between two states, one Israeli, one Palestinian.
Well, that's exactly the argument that was advanced by a lot of Israeli opposition politicians and others, that look, they say to the government, you say you want an alternative moderate Palestinian leadership, and here you are interfering with the preeminent Palestinian moderate.
And Israel says...
And Israel said, in this case, it was Uzi Landau, the Minister of Public Security, said that, well, sorry, we shouldn't be fooled by Sari Nusseibeh's seeming, his amiability. He's functioning as a Trojan horse for Arafat here in Jerusalem and undermining Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem. There's an argument made, you hear among right-wing Israelis, that Sari Nusseibeh is in fact not a moderate, that he's some sort of a closet radical, that he's actually functioned as an Iraqi spy, which he vehemently denies.
Do you think that's more conspiracy theory?
Well, as I said before, there are large numbers of conspiracy theories on both sides. It's often hard to evaluate, to get to the very heart of them. But there's little evidence that's been put forward to support that charge.
You did an article a few weeks ago in which you interviewed a suicide bomber, a Palestinian suicide bomber, who was being held in an Israeli prison. Her name was Aryan Ahmed, and she's a young woman who at the last minute decided not to go through with the suicide bombing. You described her as representative of how suicide bombers are changing. In the kind of profile that they represent. How is she different from the expected portrait of the suicide bomber?
Well, she was a student at Bethlehem University in Bethlehem, which has not produced any suicide bombers. She was a student of business administration who skipped a marketing lecture to go carry out this attack. She was a young woman, in other words, who seemed to have a bright future. She's a fluent speaker of English. She's a very self-possessed young woman from a... fairly well-to-do home. Her uncle is an engineer trained in the United States. They're as I say, a successful family. They don't seem to suffer from economic deprivation or to be despairing. Her uncle actually is a critic of suicide bombing. In her case, her fiancé had died. He was a militant leader. She believed he'd been killed by Israel. Israeli intelligence agents say he actually blew himself up accidentally. But this was part of a kind of a personal motivation for her. And that's what we're seeing. There's all kinds of motivations now in these attacks. It used to be when we first started seeing the phenomenon of suicide bombing here, that it took a great deal of time and preparation to get somebody ready to commit one of these attacks. There's often a lot of spiritual training that went into it. In some cases, according to Israeli intelligence services, people would wear their burial shroud in advance of the attack. They would be buried up to their necks in sand, left to ponder what they were facing, trying to imagine what the world looked like from their God's perspective. Now, it seems to be an almost casual affair. A woman like Irene Ahmed, feeling very angry about what Israel is doing, perhaps because of some personal turmoil, contacts someone she knows. In this case, it was a friend of her dead fiancé. And within a matter of days, she finds herself with a bomb on her back, walking through an Israeli town, and in her case, wondering what she's doing. In other cases, people have gone through with their attacks, including a 16-year-old boy who was with Ariane that day, who blew himself up in the town of Rishon LeZion in Israel.
Did she tell you exactly when and why she had second thoughts and decided not to go through with the attack?
It was partly on the drive down there, but it was really, she said, when she was walking through the town, she was carrying the bomb. She said she described it as almost a kind of epiphany. She said she looked around at the people and she looked up at the sky and she remembered what she'd been taught as a child, she said, which is that it was wrong to take any human life. And she turned back at that point. And she said that the young man with her also had second thoughts, but for reasons that are still not clear, he ultimately went through with the attack.
Well, when she decided not to go through with it and she decided to turn back, where did she go? I mean, where do you go when you have a bomb strapped to you and everyone is expecting you to go through with it, but you're not going to?
She came back. She dropped the bomb off in the car that had conveyed her there. She called the courier that had led them down there. She didn't even know the name of the town where she was. She wondered if she was in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. She didn't know. She had no idea where she was in Israel. So she called him. He called the guys in Bethlehem who had dispatched her, and there ensued a fairly furious conversation. Some pressure was put on her to go through with it. I think it's possible some threats were made. In a case like this, someone in her position would fear, obviously, for her family, that there might be some kind of reprisal taken. She said they were not happy with her. But after having been to some extent at least manipulated into this position, she now showed some strength of will and stood out against them and insisted on going back. And they finally insisted that this courier bring her back to Bethlehem, I think partly because they were afraid she'd run to the Israelis and turn them all in.
Well, you interviewed her from an Israeli prison.
That's right. A few days later, the Israelis swooped in and arrested her. And since then, they've arrested all the members of this particular cell.
How did they find out about her?
I'm not sure exactly what the precise sequence was, but they arrested, within a couple of days of the attack, they arrested this driver, a man named Ibrahim Sarachny, who was at a mall, actually outside Tel Aviv, with his wife and child, after having brought the bombers to this attack. And once they had him, interrogation quickly led to the rest of the cell, I think.
How did you get access to interviewing her?
I and a couple of other journalists I'd made several requests to interview these people that were being held in Israeli custody, and the Shin Bet, Israel's internal security agency, allowed us to interview her and also Ibrahim Sarachny separately. There was a Shin Bet agent present for the interview.
And did she feel comfortable talking with you about her motivations?
She said she felt comfortable, that she did not feel coerced. She said it was in her own interest to talk because she was hoping for some sympathy for her position. The security agents who were present did not interrupt except to steer conversation away from the nature of her interrogation. She is hoping, Ariane Ahmed is hoping to be released by the Israelis and to make a new life for herself in Jordan.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview we recorded this morning with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. When we left off, we were talking about his profile of a young woman who was set to carry out a suicide bombing, but at the last minute, shortly before it was time to detonate the bomb on her back, she changed her mind. Bennett interviewed her in an Israeli prison. So is there anything that particularly surprised you talking with her?
I guess it was the real word, I think, is just casualness of the whole process. The Israelis talk about, Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, talks about an infrastructure of terror. The use of the word infrastructure suggests a complex, sophisticated apparatus with lots of moving parts and a clear, detailed blueprint, in a sense. In fact, there's a very loosely organized series of cells now, increasingly isolated throughout the West Bank, fairly autonomous, I think, and a little slapdash in some cases. I interviewed another young suicide bomber from Jenin, a kid who blew himself up at a junction, the Megiddo Junction in Israel near Jenin. He wounded himself. He didn't hurt anybody else. And I interviewed him while he was recuperating in an Israeli hospital. Israel had gone to great pains to put this young man back together again. And his case was somewhat similar. He had, over the course of the Intifada, he'd found himself unemployed. He used to work in Israel. He'd hung around at a pool hall. Then he'd started listening to Islamic clerics who explained that he was wasting his life. He started going to mosque more often. He became angry, he said, about what Israel was doing in the West Bank. And he contacted the brother of a known militant leader in Jenin, and a day or two later, this guy took him to a house, showed him a bomb, showed him how to trigger it, and told him to find his way into Israel and basically explode himself wherever he wanted. He advised him to try to find a group of soldiers and blow himself up there. So this boy takes the bomb, gets in a cab, walks across the boundary with Israel, something that is still possible to do, although it's getting harder. On his way, he gets concerned because the bomb smells so terrible. I think it must have been made from fertilizer. He gets worried about this, so he stops in a store and buys some cheap perfume. And you have this young Palestinian man walking through the streets of an Israeli Arab village, dousing his bomb with perfume in hopes of getting past whatever kind of Israeli security he might encounter. It's, as I say, there's this kind of, this is the infrastructure of terror that the Israelis are up against. And in some ways, it's much more difficult to defeat because it's so atomized and chaotic.
You know, you're talking about the casualness with which young people now are setting out to become suicide bombers. And I wonder if you think that they are that casual, in part because of the whole media campaign that's done by the suicide bombers and the people who support and advocate them. You know, the whole glamorization of the martyr. It becomes a part of culture, because it becomes a part of everyday life. People are used to it. It's not unthinkable anymore.
I should say, by the way, in using the word casual, I don't mean to minimize what they're doing or suggest it's unimportant. I think it's more the phenomenon that you're describing. I think the reason that you're seeing Sari Nusseibeh, other Palestinian intellectuals, beginning to raise the alarm about this kind of behavior is that they're fearful that there is this kind of cultural phenomenon at work, that there's a culture of heroism growing up around these sorts of acts. And as a result, you're getting a sort of self-sustaining, self-reinforcing cycle at work where it becomes popular, heroic, to carry out these sorts of suicide attacks. That poses, they think, a long-term threat, not just to Israel, but to Palestinian society itself.
James Bennett is my guest. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. In one of your articles this morning, you referred to a big debate, a big division between the ultra-Orthodox in Israel and the rest of the country, particularly secular Jews. Can you talk a little bit about what the latest shift in the debate is, what the latest eruption in the debate is?
Well, there's constant there is a source of constant turmoil here within Israeli society, and in fact, before this intifada broke out, there was a lot of talk about Israel society fragmenting along these lines because of the secular religious split. To some extent, that debate, like other internal disputes on both sides, have been mooted by this present conflict. People on both sides say that if they didn't have the other side to rally against, they might tear themselves apart because there are so many internal splits among Palestinians and among Israelis. In this case, what's bringing it to head now is a bill pending in the Israeli parliament that would formalize what has long been the case here, which is that yeshiva students, the ultra-religious students of Judaism here, are exempt from mandatory service in the Israeli army, which all those Israeli men perform for 3 years. Their studies, furthermore, are subsidized by the state. Secular Israelis are saying this is grossly unfair, that their sons are at risk, their daughters as well, but in this case, yeshiva students are only male. Since their sons are at risk, the students of the religious should be as well.
So would you say that there's a lot of resentment now of the ultra-Orthodox who aren't fighting, but they're very representative of some of the policies that are requiring the fighting?
Well, that's the argument that's made, that in some cases these secular Israelis are defending yeshivas located in settlements in the West Bank. So they're putting their lives at stake to defend people who are exercising their religious principles, holding on to the territory they believe that by divine right has been granted by God to the Jews, and that in fact these yeshiva students should possibly be contributing a little more to their own defense. The measure, however, is likely to pass. The exemption is likely to be preserved. Yesterday, a much more modest measure was voted down in a committee. That measure would have compelled yeshiva students to perform just 2 weeks of compulsory service in the civil guards, but that didn't get anywhere in the end.
Do you get the feeling that there's a lot of people in Israel now with a kind of tortured conscience doing what they feel they need to do to protect themselves, but feeling at the same time bad about what they're doing?
There's some of that, Terry. There's some feeling. But you often hear on the Israeli side now, well, we have no choice. They feel they've been backed into a corner and left no option. And interestingly enough, recent reports from the States about the American operation in Afghanistan has made the Israelis feel a little more confident, I think, about what they're doing.
You're referring to reports that hundreds of innocent Afghans have been killed in our bombing attacks, even though they were supposed to be very precise.
Exactly. They're saying, well, at least, you know, we could be carpet bombing the West Bank and Gaza. We could be doing exactly the same thing, but we're not. And so they're using the Americans, in a sense, as a foil. There was a piece yesterday in the mass circulation Israeli Daily here by perhaps the most noted Israeli columnist, Nahum Barnea, that basically said, well, we can't ever let ourselves be like the Americans because we're much more moral people. And we don't take this kind of approach to fighting our fights, and we have to use much more pinpoint operations and much more humane tactics.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
James Bennett is my guest. He's the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief. What kind of comments are you hearing about the Bush administration and its stand on Israel and its insistence that Arafat is not a partner for peace, that basically nothing's going to happen until he leaves? What are you hearing from Israelis and Palestinians in positions of authority?
Well, Israelis in positions of authority are delighted because they feel that George Bush has wholly endorsed their position. Palestinians have been dismayed by it. The Bush administration essentially reversed what had been longstanding American policy, which was that Yasser Arafat is the only Palestinian leader strong enough to secure a peace agreement with Israel. George Bush has decided that, in fact, Yasser Arafat is a central obstacle to peace with Israel and has predicated progress towards a political solution here on Arafat's replacement. As I said earlier, there's created a somewhat dangerous political dynamic from the Bush administration's perspective, which is that Yasser Arafat's popularity seems to be growing as a result. And in fact, some diplomats here say the Americans are now starting to back away from the idea of holding elections early next year in the Palestinian Authority because they're afraid that Yasser Arafat will score an overwhelming victory. So it's paradoxical. We've gone from saying that we want Arafat to be strong to fearing that, in fact, he might be too strong and that that will undermine the Bush administration's aims or at least, make them look silly.
If the United States does go ahead with plans to invade Iraq and try to overthrow Saddam Hussein, what might that mean for the Middle East?
Well, this is the $64,000 question. Many Israelis and Palestinians believe that what the Bush administration has been doing is essentially trying to put this conflict on the back burner, push it out of sight until the Iraq operation can be taken care of. That's regarded as the Bush administration's top priority. And the feeling on both sides is that it's going to completely scramble the chessboard. Everything will depend on what the outcome is. The Israelis are hoping that it will rewrite the rules in the Middle East, that it'll put pressure on the Syrians, the Iranians to change their ways. Palestinians are also very, very concerned, obviously, about any action against an Arab nation. And everybody's just waiting to see what the impact might be in the end.
Is Israel worried about Scud missiles that Iraq might aim at them?
Well, and this is a question. During the last war in Iraq, there were Scud missiles aimed at Israel that did hit Israel, and the Bush administration at the time took great pains, put tremendous pressure on the Israeli government not to respond because if Israel came into the war, the Americans feared it would shatter the coalition of Arab states that the Bush administration had built to wage its war. That is, that Arabs couldn't be seen as fighting alongside Israel against another Arab nation. That same dilemma is likely to face both the Israelis and the Americans this time around as well. And it's far from certain how the Israelis would respond.
Are you satisfied with the kind of access that you have now as a journalist, or do you feel like you are not being allowed access that you need to fairly cover the story?
It's very difficult getting around in the West Bank right now. The Israelis have been loosening some of the restrictions on journalists. The areas that were declared closed military zones are, for the most part, open now. And we no longer, in theory at least, have to find back roads, dirt roads around Israeli positions and other sorts of safeguards to find our way into these Palestinian areas. Often, though, it's still very hard to get across checkpoints. It can take a very, very long time. Recently, it took me 4 hours to get back from Ramallah to Jerusalem, which is a distance of less than 10 miles in this case. So it can be very, very hard to get around.
Now, I know last week you became a father for the first time. Your wife had a baby. I want to congratulate you on the birth of your son. And is it a difficult time to be having a baby while you're covering all this fighting?
I haven't, to be honest, I haven't completely processed that like a lot of the really intense experiences that I've had in the last few months. For us, it's been a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it is a little hard to go back to focusing on the destruction, the violence, and the venom here. But life does go on here on both sides, by the way. People are having babies on both sides, and they're getting married, and they're trying to move on with their lives. and conduct their lives in very, very difficult circumstances. Our circumstances are certainly a lot less difficult than everybody, than most everybody else's. And as I say, I haven't reconciled all this yet.
Well, James Bennett, congratulations on the birth of your son.
Thank you.
My best to your family. Thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. Our interview was recorded this morning. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer today is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Chaim Potok, who chronicled Jewish life in his novels and works of nonfiction. He has died of brain cancer. He was 73. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview in which he discussed his life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.